So really, no welcome here. We are glad. If you are brand new to Jesus, if you're brand new to church, or if it's been a really long time, like, welcome. We're so glad you're here. We're on this journey learning how to follow Jesus, how to be apprenticed to Jesus and his teachings, his life. And so we've just spent the whole fall in a series all about being apprentices of Jesus. And so we're going to dive into a topic on community. And so we want to pray together. And I really want to thank Pastor Ben and Pastor Kevin for the last 2 weeks and the sermons that they've preached. Thank you to both of you. Just those sermons on humility and on what it means to worship the King, bringing your whole life before King Jesus. Just so grateful for both of them. So pray with me and let's dive into what God would say to us this morning. Jesus, we're listening. We are here. We're ready to hear from you. We want to pray that you would remove distractions from this past week, that you would do what only you can do, that you would allow us to gaze upon you, upon your goodness that we've been singing about this morning, that we would that right now our mind, our heart, our soul, all of our decisions, that we would be brought before you, and that you as King would teach us. We want to know how to live. We want to know how to love you. And so we give this time to you and pray that you would be King in this place. Amen. Okay, so we've been asking this question throughout the whole fall. Do you want to know God? Do you want to know God's love and God's freedom and God's hope and God's grace? If so, what we talked about the entire fall is that the way to know God's love and life and hope and joy and freedom is to be apprenticed to Jesus. Or in the language of the New Testament, it's to be a disciple of Jesus. That it's only in apprenticeship to Jesus where we truly learn what it means to love God with our whole heart. And it's only in apprenticeship to Jesus where we learn how to love our neighbor as we love ourselves. That there is this beautiful picture in the Hebrew language, it's the word shalom, that there is this beautiful peace that comes over our whole life when we are living right before God and before our neighbor. And so we want to be apprenticed to Jesus. We want to be changed by Jesus. But the question we've been wrestling with is how? How are we changed by Jesus? What does that look like? Because many of us are frustrated. Many of us who have called ourselves Christians for decades, we're frustrated because we claim to follow Jesus, but we remain addicted for years, stuck in bitterness for years. We struggle with lack of forgiveness towards another. We've got weird relational conflicts in our lives. We've got messed up spending habits in our life. We're constantly running away from problems and issues. Many of us who claim to follow Jesus were crippled by worry, and we just can't get our heart and our mind under control. And so the question we're asking is, how, Jesus, do you change us? Like, what does that even look like? Does it mean that we just try harder? Is that the Christian life? No. And an author named Dallas Willard did a great job, I think, in getting us to understand how we are changed in the kingdom of God, how Jesus changes us. And he said, in order to change, that we need three things: vision, intention, and means. Vision, intention, means. This is recap for those of you who are with us in the fall. But when anyone wants to change, they need these three ingredients. And so if you can picture, let's say I wanted to change, and so we're just going to use an example. Let's say I wanted to play guitar. So first of all, I need a vision of me just like wailing on the guitar, like Jimmy Page or Eric Clapton, right? So I have a vision. I'm like, ooh, I like that vision of me being able to play like that, which I definitely cannot do. So I want to do that. But then I need intention, step two. So it's the will. It's going, okay, I'm going to do this, right? It's that will, and you're like, okay, I'm gonna be a good guitar player. But third, we need means. Or you could the language you could use here is a way or a path. What would be the path? Well, if I wanted to be a guitar player, I would need to go buy an electric guitar, which I do not have one, so I need to go buy one. Then I need to sign up for a class. And then maybe I would join a band and then be in a group that's practicing and playing songs. I have a path, a road, a way to do that. And so if you can picture me learning to play guitar, if I only have vision and intention, then I've got lots of passion without a path. You following? I've got lots of passion without a path. What I actually need is a way. I need someone who has gone before me to show me how to change. And when we think about faith, when I ask the question, how does Jesus change me? Well, absolutely, there's a vision. He gives us a vision. Look what your life could look like. Totally free, loving God, loving others, set free from worry and bitterness and addiction. Many of us in the room, we can picture ourselves there. Like, wouldn't that be amazing? And then many of us in the room have had lots of intention. We're like, we are going to be different. We've got the will to be different. We're going to change. And by January 13th in a new year, many of us have already, you know, fallen off the wagon, as it were. We're like, oh, okay. Vision and intention, it wasn't enough to get me there. What I need is a plan. I need the way. And so Jesus promises that he is the way, the truth, and the life. And so he gives us a path to follow. Do you remember that Jesus, some of his final words were, teach them to obey everything I have commanded you, and surely I'm with you always. Jesus has a path for us. There is a way that we follow as disciples of Jesus. And we want to follow it. We need the means, the path, the way. Apprentice to Jesus, we follow his life and his plan. Think about Jesus' life for a minute. Jesus read the scriptures. Jesus prayed. Jesus gave. Jesus rested. Jesus took the Sabbath. Jesus served. Jesus spent time in silence. Jesus rebuked the works of the devil. Jesus loved his neighbor. And Jesus lived a life of community, life together with his disciples. And for the next several years, North Langley, we are going to do what Jesus did. If we want to be changed by Jesus, we have to do what he did. Series by series, throughout the next several years, we are going to walk as apprentices of Jesus, doing what he told us to do and what he did in his life. And series by series, we're going to highlight a different thing that Jesus did, and we're going to do them together. You see, his life and teachings, they are the way, and we're going to do them. John Ortberg, in The Life You've Always Wanted, says it this way. He says, following Jesus, or being a disciple of Jesus, simply means learning from him how to arrange my life around activities that enable me to live in the fruit of the Spirit. Remember, we don't change ourselves, not at all. But when we do what Jesus did, we open up our life, our soul, our heart, our mind to be changed by the Holy Spirit. So today, what we're doing is we are launching our very first mini-series called Life Together. We are going to talk about one of the things that Jesus did, the way he lived, because as his apprentices, again, we want to do what he did. Jesus lived in rich community with others, and we want to do that. So we begin a 6-week series on Christian community called Life Together. Life together. So here we go. Making your way in the world today takes everything you've got. Taking a break from all your worries, it sure would help a lot. Wouldn't you like to get away? Sometimes you wanna go. Body knows your name. And they're always glad you came. You wanna be where you can see. The troubles are all the same. I'm gonna ask you to sing it in a second. You wanna be where? Da-da-da-dun-dun, da-da-da-dun-dun. Oh, what a good show. Cheers, the best. I just like, whenever I watch the intro to Cheers, I just feel so nostalgic for like my home growing up. And you know, I miss Sam and Carla and Norm and Cliff and Frasier and Rebecca and Woody. How many of you miss that cast? Anyone miss that cast? 10 of you. Oh, and we got clappers. That's good. I wanted them to know my name because they were the coolest. You know, it's interesting. I was reflecting on television in the 1990s. It's a decade that I'm most familiar with when it comes to television. And it's interesting. Like, we loved that idea that, you know, Cheers, you know, everybody would know my name. Or we loved the I'll be there for you culture of Friends. Or the pop-in friendship culture of Seinfeld, right? It's interesting because TV in the 90s was, it was like, it was living out something that, when I think about it, I wonder if our secular culture was dying for. Community. To be in a group of people that know us. Like real community, true life together. I wonder if some of these shows were just a reflection of a deep yearning and longing. Because one of the things our secular age has promised us is promised us happiness and freedom. But whether it's the advent of lots of technology that kind of promises us a little iLife, a very independent iLife, or maybe it's the way we move around when it comes to careers, how transient our culture is, but our secular age is actually leading to greater loneliness. I remember growing up and just, one of my favorite Beatles song, which is kind of weird to say it, but it was Eleanor Rigby. And I don't know why that was my favorite song, it was beautiful, but the haunting lyrics, all the lonely people, where do they all come from? Where do they all belong? And it was just, I think the Beatles were echoing just this growing sense of loneliness that accompanies a secular culture. Albert Schweitzer says, we're all so much together, but we're all dying of loneliness. Isn't that true? We're like so together, even social media, it's like we're all connected, and yet we're dying of loneliness. Or Jean Vanier, founder of L'Arche Communities, says it this way, we all carry our own deep wound, which is the wound of our loneliness. We find it hard to be alone, and we try to flee from this in hyperactivity through television and in a million other ways. Like we overcompensate, so we just busy ourselves with hyperactivity. Or in the words of Mother Teresa, the biggest disease today is not leprosy or tuberculosis, but rather the feeling of being unwanted, uncared for, and deserted by everybody. The greatest evil is the lack of love and charity, the terrible indifference towards one's neighbor. Each of these authors are reflecting on, or leaders, I should say, are reflecting on a great loneliness in our world. We all feel it. There is this longing to be with the other. And I know from firsthand experience that pornography is one of the desires within us to be connected to the other and to have some kind of intimacy with another. And it promises us a shortcut. You don't actually have to know the person, but you can experience an intimacy with someone on a screen. But all pornography does is it just fans the flame of greater loneliness in the life of the person who consumes it. Which, by the way, I just saw a study this week, a recent study, that three major porn video sites now get more traffic than eBay, Twitter, Wikipedia, Instagram, Reddit, and even Netflix. Because there's this loneliness that comes with a secular age. And here's what I want for today. I want us to be caught by a beautiful vision given to us. But it's not just a vision, it's a beautiful reality of the gift of the church, of God's gift of community to us. That here in a lonely secularism that we would be drawn to the gift that God has given his people. Christianity offers a powerful alternative to the secular age and to the loneliness that we feel. So let me walk through some scripture verses, and I hope you'll catch the beauty of the gift of God. It all begins in the Garden of Eden. You'll remember that God created humanity, and He saw that it was good and that there was a flourishing of relationship, Adam and Eve, in a beautiful relationship with a wonderful relationship with God. So it was like horizontal and vertical relationships. We're all doing great, right? But with the coming of sin and the deception of this character, the serpent in the book of Genesis, there was this deception, and this deception led to sin, and sin led to brokenness. There was brokenness between one another and between humanity and God. Sin leads to broken relationships. Broken relationships between me and my neighbor and a broken relationship with God. Sin does that 100% of the time. And so throughout the scriptures, we see the effects of this brokenness. Even though God had started this rescue plan through a man named Abraham and his great family, the people of Israel, we see throughout the pages of the Old Testament, if you're new to the Bible, it's the kind of the first two-thirds of the Bible, we see sin just leading to great brokenness in the world. Brokenness in relationship between humans and God and humans and each other. But there were these prophets that spoke of a day that would come where God would make things right. He would restore relationships, not just human relationships, but relationships with God himself. And listen to Ezekiel. He's a prophet, and he was speaking of a time that would come when God would do something new. This is God speaking. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. Do you hear that? He said that there's going to come a time where I will put my spirit in you. That when God puts his spirit in us, suddenly we would be made right before God. His spirit in us. And something incredible happened hundreds of years after that prophetic word from Ezekiel. We're with Jesus at the cross. It's the moment Jesus gives up his life for the sake of the world. And what happens? Listen to Matthew 27. And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The curtain that separated God from the people. It was the Holy of Holies, the place where God dwelt. That curtain that separated that was torn in two. What's going on? What's happening? At the death of Jesus, what is happening? Well, some of you will know 3 days later, Jesus rises from the dead. He spends time with his followers and he ascends back to heaven and he says, wait in the city of Jerusalem because something huge is going to happen. Something massive is going to happen. You're going to receive a gift. 120 followers of Jesus were praying together. They're in the city of Jerusalem. They're praying. They're waiting for a gift. You can read about this in the book of Acts, chapter 2. They're waiting for this gift that would be given to them. They're praying, and all of a sudden, the sound of a violent wind kind of comes into their prayer meeting. You can just imagine the sound. Violent wind, and all of a sudden, these tongues of fire started to descend on these 120 people gathered to pray. So wind and fire, by the way, wind and fire, which was always a picture of the glory of God coming upon his temple. Wind and fire coming upon his temple. But what was happening in that moment was the wind and fire was coming upon a people. And all of a sudden, we begin to see that in the gift of the Spirit, this was the moment God was gifting his Spirit to the church to fulfill that prophecy from Ezekiel, that one day God would fill his people with his own Spirit, that this was the moment that God was filling his new temple. North Langley, this is huge. This is the moment in Acts 2 where God fills his new temple. The temple would no longer be a building, brick and mortar, but it would be a people, a gathered people experiencing life together. When I've read the book of Acts, I've been drawn to things like, you know, speaking in tongues or the speaking of other languages. And when we read it, sometimes we read it through an individualistic lens. But if you actually catch what's happening, the gift of the Spirit falls upon a people, a gathered people, that this people is now the place where God's glory rests. a gathered people, not of lone rangers or solo discipleship, but a bunch of people gathered together, that this is where God's glory falls. Wind and fire upon his new temple. The church gathered. And I want you to listen to what this new family, this new temple, look like. Picture yourself, you're there in Jerusalem, and you're picturing this new people filled with the Spirit, the new temple. Listen to this. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. Together, 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 the evidence of the filling of the Spirit is people together, living life together. Listen, they loved being together. They loved learning together. They loved eating together. They loved praying together. They loved giving to one another. It was attractive. It was God's love made real on earth as it is in heaven, in community. And North Langley, this is who we are. This is who we are. Our gathering today is a small reflection of something that has gone on for 2,000 years. It's a continuation of this moment. Together, it's who we are. My hope today is that you would have eyes to see that you are, for those of you who have given your life to Jesus, and you are a Christian, follower of Jesus, that you are part of God's new temple, not a building, a people, and you're part of his new family. We're not made to do this alone. When you read the New Testament and you read the book of Acts, we're not meant to do this alone. Nobody's doing this by themselves here. And when we became Christians, we died to our old self, and that old self was marked by individualism. Pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. Find freedom on your own. Find the good life on your own. But we died to that. In our baptism, we died to our old life, going down into the waters. We died to our individualistic life. And when we came up out of the water, we joined a family. We joined the new temple where God dwells in his glory. See, apprentices of Jesus know that we're not lone rangers. Jesus had his group of 12, and it was 70, and it was 120, and then it was thousands were gathered at Pentecost. From day one, this whole thing about following Jesus has been something that we do together. But as you know, in our modern age, like, we are constantly breathing in the air of individualism, right? It's like fed to us on a platter every day through all kinds of media, through the way we've shaped our lives and shaped how we live. We're just eating it up. And in our modern Christianity, we also have a problem because we have a bit of a do-it-yourself spirit. Spiritual thing happening. DIY, right? Do it yourself, spiritual thing. Because for many of us, the temptation is to see community, life together, as simply one option in a buffet of options of what you could do in your own Christian journey. Let me describe this. I picture the hometown buffet that my grandpa, Big Daddy, used to take me and my brother after church. He would take us to a buffet. And, you know, you pay a few bucks and you got your little tray, and in Oklahoma, and I'm going through and there's all kinds of, like, under the glass, right? All kinds of stuff heated up. Who knows how long that stuff has been sitting there. And you choose. Well, when it was up to me and my brother, we chose mac and cheese, and we went and we chose pizza, and then we chose Jell-O, and then we grabbed some soft serve ice cream at the end of the row. And that would be lunch, because it's a buffet of options. And I think about that sometimes in the DIY spiritual thing that we've got going in the church. Because if it's up to us, this is the mac and cheese and the pizza and the jello and the ice cream. Even though that might sound disgusting to you, follow the image. Style of worship. And we do it ourselves. We find that perfect style of worship in a church building that works for us, in a service time that's convenient, being part of a group that always challenges us, and maybe we get something out of it. Different services, different podcasts, different books to read, different camps to attend, the perfect camp for me, the perfect mission trip that I can go on that works with my schedule, the perfect school to send my kids to, and the right retreat to go on that will fit my needs and where I'm at in life. And all those things, you know that I know, I hope you know that I know, that these are beautiful things, they're wonderful things. They're part of the beautiful life of Christianity, many wonderful options. But the problem is if we only take the things that we want, we've got this DIY thing happening in our faith. And what we do, which is what I did and my brother did, is we skip over in the buffet the Brussels sprouts. And we skip over the asparagus and we skip over the broccoli. And we're not going to put those on our plate, for sure. And we're going to go right to the jello. And the Brussels sprouts and the broccoli and the asparagus, I get it. Some of you are health nuts and you actually like that kind of stuff. And so, but just again, go with the image here, is that some of that stuff that we skip over is found in being in a small group. It's being in a community group, a life group, an apprentice group, a cell group, whatever you want to call it, a small group. Because sometimes in that small group, what we find is that we're dealing with relational conflict in that small group. And honestly, we could all do without the relational conflict, right? We can all do without the need to confess sin to a brother or a sister. We could learn to do without loving somebody who is awkward. Learning to commit to community when we can easily picture a million other things to do with our time. And the danger is that unless we see that Christianity is not a buffet of options, but it's a life together in community, then we will miss out on what is actually healthy for us, on what's actually good for us. And what is good for us is to be in a place where we are not alone, and we have those who love us and care for us and are speaking truth into our lives, and in whom we can confess our sin and walk through seasons of life together. We have to beware of DIY spirituality. Life together in Christian community is beautiful and hard at the same time. It will require confession, reconciliation at times, care for one another in difficult seasons. It will require time, lots of time, sometimes boring times and sometimes amazingly good times. Hard seasons, competing priorities. But the deal is that this is God's plan for his apprentices, is that we would walk together in life, in and out of all kinds of seasons together. And I think one of the things we need to do is, step one, is we need to rebuke the idealism that we have about life together. For many of us in the room, we're like, okay, I can get on that train, Matthew. And in our minds, we picture what this beautiful community of people are, which is funny because it's kind of like some of the people on the video, right? Everyone's holding just these glasses at a really cool table and everyone's laughing together, right? And we know that that's not necessarily true. Maybe for like a few seconds, that's probably true. But we're picturing that to be what our life together will look like. And so I think one of the most healthy things we can do is just get rid of the idealism. And actually to understand that disillusionment can actually be a gift when it comes to Christian community. The quicker that we get disillusioned or the bubble is burst, the better. The church is not perfect. It is a hospital for sinners and all of us in need of mercy and grace. The author Sheldon Van Auken, who wrote A Severe Mercy, he was friends with C.S. Lewis, he lost his wife. Anyway, he writes this book, and in it he tells the story of he and his wife, when they bought a new car, they took a hammer and they just like dented the car in. And they said, you know, the action freed him from worrying about the car being perfect. And just from the get-go, it's like, okay, it's not perfect now. Good, now I can drive in freedom. Not worried about people opening their doors or bumping into me. Done. Now I'm free to just drive my car because cars are for driving. And I know some of you are like car fans and you go to car shows and you pay money to look at cars. I don't get that world, but cars are for driving. And no car is ever going to make it without some failure. And so I think what I want to do is take a swing with a hammer at that notion of that pristine, perfect community. It's untouched. Everyone's like laughing and loving life together. Even though there is great joy in community, please hear me, there's great joy in community. It often comes after a long journey, hitting the road together. Sometimes we get banged up along the way, but let's not expect perfect community. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who wrote a book called Life Together, which is where we get our title for our series here. By the way, if you're going to read one book, read that one. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Life Together. And he says this. He says, he who loves his dream of a community more than the Christian community itself becomes a destroyer of the latter, even though his personal intentions may be ever so honest and earnest and sacrificial. I got to read the first part of that again. It's too good not to read it again. He who loves his community, his dream of a community more than the Christian community itself becomes a destroyer of the latter. Let's not come to Life Together for the next 6 weeks with some kind of idealism. And the question I have for us is, are we forfeiting beautiful, joyful, real Christian community because of our idealism? Are we forfeiting Christian community because the people are difficult or awkward or unlike us or time-consuming? By the way, I always forget, seriously, I mean this, Matthew always forgets that I am the broken person that someone else is going to have to love. Somebody else is going to have to deal with. I never think of it that way though, right? We think of the people in the group, and are these the kind of people that I could be in community with? And they're probably asking the same thing. Matthew, with his mixed bag of joys and sins, they're going to have to deal with me. Is our idealism getting in the way of our apprenticeship to Jesus? Remember, life together is Jesus' idea. I'm sure if we set our really brilliant minds to it, we would have come up with a different plan. It probably wouldn't have involved a bunch of broken people learning to follow Jesus together. Like, we probably wouldn't have come up with that. But we receive it as a good gift from Jesus, who knows what we need more than we know ourselves. Life together is Jesus' idea. We are the new temple. He sees us very differently than maybe we see ourselves, for we are the place where he has chosen to rest his glory. Wind and fire upon his new temple. He loves us. And in the mess of Christian community, it's where we experience the glory of God, his presence. Life together, it's where Jesus dwells in his glory. Some of you may be familiar with an author named John Ortberg. He's a pastor out of California. He tells a great story of a friend of his who went down south, and he didn't know what grits were. And so he's talking to a southern server, nice lady, and he says, "What exactly is a grit?" And her response was classic. She says, "Honey, they don't come by themselves." They don't come by themselves. Grits don't exist in isolation. You can't order a grit. Just like the church, we come together. It's a package deal. All of us together. Jesus says this in John 13. He says, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." And if you're with us in the fall, you'll know that this love is not just a feeling, but it's agape love. It's an action. It's self-sacrifice for the other. That this is the life that Jesus is calling us to. We need to be around people to be able to agape love them. We just have to be rubbing shoulders with others to be in that place. You know, when I was writing the sermon this past week, I was reflecting on the beauty of the church. And oftentimes I'll share something maybe self-deprecating or something for my own story, but I was actually like really encouraged of the gift of the church in my life and the gift of Christian community. And you need to know I'm not talking about the nuclear family here. I'm talking about the church. Married, single, older, younger, multiracial, ethnic, lingual, multilingual. That as I've grown up, I became a Christian when I was 7 years old in my parents' car. I gave my life to Jesus. The following year, when I was 8 years old, I was baptized. And for the last over 30 years, as I've been following Jesus, I look back and I see the places where I grew the most were those moments when I was enjoying church community. It's not always been easy, that there are periods of my life where it's been harder than others. But looking back, I'm filled with gratefulness at people that I don't see anymore in different seasons, in different churches, different parts of my life. But so grateful for the people that have been there my whole journey. And I recognize, I hope that all of us as Christians would come humble and realize this was never a DIY thing. Never. That if we're humble enough, we'll realize that there were always people that God had placed in our life to challenge us, to love us, to care for us, always. And my hope is that we as a church community will experience that together, that we would know the joy of life together. I've tasted it. It goes beyond people that are like me. It goes beyond my own family. It's the church. It's this. It's Christian community living together, following Jesus. So here's what I want to summarize this time together with. This is week one of 6 weeks, so we're going to talk a lot about this. But the summary for today is this. I want you to know that life together is a choice, and it's not chasing a feeling. Let's go ahead and take a hammer, and let's ding up that car, right? Let's get rid of that idealism. It's not a feeling we're chasing. It's a choice. It's a choice to commit to the gift Jesus has given you. Not to live this life alone, but to enjoy it in community. And so I want to ask you just a very clear question. Are you, as a disciple, as an apprentice of Jesus, are you in a group that is meeting together consistently, learning together, eating together, praying together, and giving together? And if not, would you join one? Would you join one? That's our homework assignment for this week, is to join a life group. Notice, I'm not saying pray about it. I already know the answer. So don't go home and pray about it. Well, I think I'm going to pray about whether I should join a community. No need to pray. Do it. Just do it. If you want to sign up for a life group here at North Langley, we have what we call life groups if you're new to Christianity. But they are groups of about 8 to 15 people that meet in a living room. Just to let you know, the last few days, lots of our life group leaders have been meeting, preparing for this new season of life together. I was just upstairs a few minutes ago, a room packed with these amazing people who are life group leaders. And there are new leaders who are opening up their lives and their living rooms to welcoming some of you, many of you in the room who want to join community. You can't sign up today just for technical reasons, but around Wednesday, feel free to go and sign up online. You can go to our website, nlcc.ca. We would love for you to join a life group. If you have any problems with the tech stuff, just come next Sunday or email Pastor Tim. Let him know you're interested in joining a group. And for those of you who are already in a group, you'll know that this week we're gonna ask all of our life groups to reflect on Christian community. And so you'll hear more about that through your leaders. But I want to end with this. I want to end with the gospel as we close our time together. Because I want you to see how valuable the church is in God's eyes. I want to ask you this. Have you ever wondered how a painting, a piece of art, is valued? Let's say you're walking through a museum and you see a bunch of paintings and you're like, weird. How do they know how much to sell that painting for? And I've always wondered, you know, I've wondered, how much is the Mona Lisa worth? Because I actually don't really like the Mona Lisa. It's really creepy. I find it's a creepy painting. And I know an art history person will challenge that and talk about all kinds of stuff. But when I look at the painting, I think, creepy. And I wonder, how is that painting valued? Because I read an article that in 1962, the Mona Lisa was valued at $100 million. 1962. So if you take inflation into account, that 1962 value is estimated to be about $780 million. $780 million. And then one UK estimate said that it would be valued today at $1.6 billion. And I'm scratching my head going, why? I would put so many other things on the wall. I'd take one of those IKEA things that just has splattered paint. I'd put it on the wall before that. But what the world is willing to pay for the art, that's its value, which is interesting. And so now here, final thought. We look at the cross. Now calculate the value of the church. The value of Christian community. The value of the church is what Jesus was willing to pay for it. He was willing to pay his own life, his own blood, giving up his own life on a cross for her. Next week, we're going to look at how the church is the bride of Christ. So beautiful, so treasured. There's so much value. He loves us as we gather together. So as I end, listen again to the beautiful bride gathered in the city of Jerusalem 2,000 years ago. Can we stand together as we listen? They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. King Jesus, we receive the beautiful gift of your bride. We know that it is together where you dwell in glory. So come and dwell in glory among us. Gather us together. Pull us out of our isolated, lonely lives and gather us in community. Jesus, we want to confess that we know that Christian community is not easy. It's not easy. But it's a good gift that you give us. And so we receive it and we pray that 6 weeks from now, that we will see our church gather together in living rooms and coffee shops all across our city, living life together for your glory and your honor. Amen.